Welcome. This is A Lost Plot, the podcast where cinematic plots are taken apart piece by piece to determine what makes that movie great or why it has been forgotten today. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we are back. We are back for another episode of A Lost Plot. I am your host, Maverick Dixon, here with our guest today, Avalon.
Hello, and leho, konnichiwa, and hola.
We are back today with a brand new release, Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, released in 2022, if you don't happen to be listening to this recently. It's directed by Ryan Coogler. It is produced by Kevin Feige and Nate Moore. It's got Letitia Wright as Shuri, Lupita Nyong'o as Nakia, Danai Gurira as Okoye. We've got Winston Duke as M'Baku, Martin Freeman, Everett K. Ross. We've got Tenoch Huerta Mejia as Namor, and the list goes on. But before we get into the meat of this content, and as an obvious preface, this will have spoilers. But Avalon, what is Black Panther Wakanda Forever about?
Okay, so if you haven't followed the Marvel movies up to now, this kind of takes place right after Endgame and the events of Avengers, but also there are some of the other Marvel properties like Falcon and Winter Soldier. You can clearly tell take place between this one and that movie.
Okay.
So, but anyways, the story starts off with apparently Black Panther or T'Challa, Chadwick Boseman's character from the first movie. He apparently is dying, and it follows his sister in the lab trying to recreate the heart herb from the first movie to try to save his life.
Right.
She's unsuccessful, and Chadwick and T'Challa dies. So, and then the movie picks up a year later where Shuri, Letitia, her character, like, she's still grieving more or less, but she's hiding it more. Her mom is kind of moving on, like she's starting to let go of her grief and move forward, but Letitia is still holding on to her grief, and they're trying to move forward with Wakanda as a nation and with world politics, the world like making demands of them, and their vibranium. Then all of a sudden, an incident in the Atlantic reveals someone else has vibranium in the world, and it's another hidden nation. So, and then from there, the story becomes, who is this other nation? What is going on? And more or less follows the grief, dealing with the grief of losing her brother from Shuri's perspective.
Yeah. Now, I will say that it was interesting, especially after Chadwick Boseman's passing, to wonder what they were going to do with a sequel to this movie.
Mm-hmm.
There was, I would say, just in from a development perspective, from the storyline, the whole movie in many ways seemed like an homage to Chadwick Boseman and his contribution to the Black Panther character and to the Marvel franchise as a whole. And they didn't really pass over that. It actually became central to how they weaved in the story, which I thought, From a honorific standpoint, it was very cool to see that. But also from the storytelling perspective, I think they did some very excellent things with this. But let's get into it. The opening scene really shows off that death of T'Challa, and that grieving process. What was your impression of how they started off the movie? And it set the stage for everything going forward. How did you think about
the opening scene?
Yeah.
The opening scene was maybe a little brief, but it was a good introduction, like showing, giving us kind of this, I don't know how you say this, like this starting point, this foundation, more or less, for the events that take place throughout the rest of the movie.
Yeah. No, definitely.
As far as the way it was portrayed, I think it was well done for what it was. It was okay. It was pretty well done.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't really find much fault with it, if that's right. So.
Well, no, it's not like you necessarily have to find fault. I think in regards to setting the stage, they definitely did it well, mm-hmm. right? They show just the bond between Shuri and her brother T'Challa really being compromised, and Shuri's desperation to make sure that he's okay mm-hmm. and he doesn't die, and that she's really helpless to stop him.
Yeah.
Or to stop his death. It was very, I think, a good... And then they have the whole ritual of him being buried and all of the elements that went into that. It also harkens back to some of the traditions that they build on in the first one, building this whole kingdom with its whole perspective and its whole... all the elements that they put in place to make it a unique world, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just another nation that does things that we're all common with, but they have these very strong tribal traditions they stick to make sure that they to make sure that the kingdom is cohesive, right? And to deliberately pass on the torch from one person to the other. And so they continue that from the first movie into this one at the very beginning with T'Challa's death and bringing Shuri in. Mm-hmm. Once again, just solidifying the kind of world, and especially how Wakanda is different from the rest of the world and how it acts and what it does. Really, really liked that opening. I thought it resets you in the world, especially if you haven't seen Black Panther, the first one, recently.
Mm-hmm.
But then they really move on pretty quickly from there to the... I guess, desperation of the world to see, to get access to this vibranium, right? That's the big thing. Now that everyone knows it exists and that Wakanda has it, how can they get a hold of it? And that's where you see the submarine, exploration finding this new vibranium. And then the sudden attack by this sea empire on these U.S. forces and their sudden disappearance. What was your impression of that? Because that's really where
plot gets going. It's an interesting introduction. Like, I mean, of course, like, at some point, the Marvel was going to introduce the Atlanteans or the Namor and the people of the ocean.
Uh-huh.
And it was an interesting introduction, like, kind of giving them this almost mythical, like, see, almost, like, monstrous opening, more or less, where it's, like, this freaky, you got this idea of almost, like, Swamp Thing or something, where it's, like, some creature, like, hidden in the darkness is gonna strike at you and can manipulate you through sounds and whatnot.
Yeah, the whole, almost, like, horror type of entrance definitely gave more of that creepy feel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And especially when you're doing with the unknown, like introducing like something mysterious and unknown, it is a good starting point to give like that interesting like fear, dread starting point where it's like, what is this? Like, who is this? Like, what? Like, you're given a glimpse of what they can do. And it's like, is this like, it almost seems like they're an enemy. Like, this is what they can do. Like, how afraid should we be, more or less? Can we deal with this?
Yeah, exactly. And I do think, definitely movies to play on that idea of the fear of the unknown is definitely a good strategy. Mm-hmm. I think especially for evil characters or quote unquote introducing an enemy in a show or in a movie or whatever. I mean, you see that for example in Lord of the Rings, one of the big things that's terrifying about the ring race is that you don't see their faces, right? Mm-hmm. And so the mystery surrounding that is something that your mind plays into trying to figure out and imagine these terrible things that it could be. And so the similar kind of thing is going on here where they introduce these characters who don't, you don't really see at first. You don't really know what their powers are, what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the darkness of the depths of the ocean. It's a good scene setting, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that ends up getting them engaged, right? So there's the idea that, oh, this is the Wakandans who did this, and that's what the Americans think. Turns out that's not the case. There's this whole engagement where Shuri and what's her name?
Okoye.
Okoye, thank you. Go off to find whoever developed this technology that can find vibranium when it previously couldn't be found. And that's where they get they engage with Dominique Thorne's character,
Riri Williams.
Yeah. Riri Williams, who ends up becoming Ironheart later in the movie. A little bit of like a plot foil, I thought her character was, but it wasn't bad.
Yeah. No, it was. There are certain things in this movie, if like, and this is probably where some of the faults of the movie come through. There's definitely some things that are kind of forced in, more or less, but not completely forced in. Like, they did try to weave it in naturally,
right?
But there was almost some level of force still applied to the plot. Like, was Riri Williams fully essential to the story? I don't know. Like, especially as I thought about it after watching the movie, it was like one of those character things where it's like, I mean, you have the scientist thing, and even Namor later in their conversations, like, the scientist is almost not important. The point thing is that the world will know about us, and then that's when the conflict will begin. So it's like, even he acknowledges at that point in the movie, is like, it's not really about the scientist anymore. So it's almost like, okay, sure, it was like this point to start this pursuit that kind of becomes not important at a certain point later on.
Right.
So it's like, okay, was this fully necessary to the story? I mean, what does she even contribute to the story after that? Not very much in terms of value and such. Like, she creates the Ironheart armor, sure, but it's not like she provides a plot point necessarily.
Right. She's kind of, I would say, similar to Okoye in this movie, where she's in, well, Okoye actually, I would say, almost has more of at least an emotional value in this movie than Riri Williams does.
Yes.
But it's not like she's central to the plot line, or Okoye is central to the plot line. Riri Williams is for the sole purpose of getting Wakanda engaged with the Atlanteans, or the people of Talokan, the underwater kingdom of Talokan.
Yeah.
Talokan, whatever, however you want to say it. And once they're engaged, it's kind of like, okay, so her character becomes a little bit obsolete.
Yeah. The same thing could be said about Martin Freeman's character at that point in the movie, too.
It's true.
Like,
it's true.
His part in the movie is essentially over by that point.
Right. And you really don't see him at all after that until the very end, where they free him because he was being sent to prison.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a whole nother discussion, but it's like his subplot in that movie is almost non-essential.
Yeah, exactly.
So
these little subplots didn't necessarily detract from the movie.
True.
I'm just not sure what they added.
Yeah,
but they were interesting. At least I would say, at least they were interesting points, right? I would say that,
yeah, they weren't, it wasn't boring. It wasn't like you were like, oh, when is this over? When's the next important scene going to take place?
It's right.
Like, it held your interest.
Right. Whereas, for example, let's just say Okoye's character, where she's, her little, subplot being, dishonorably discharged from her spot as the leader of the, Dora Milaje, is significant, not just for her as an individual, because it's her life as she knows it is basically over.
Yeah.
But also because it prepares her for taking on the mantle of the Midnight Angels, and also shows her individual struggle of the losses she's experienced through this whole thing, right? And then contrast that to the losses of characters such as Ramonda, who is the Sovereign Queen Mother, or Shuri, and how those different losses have come in conflict, right?
Yeah.
And so that's where a side plot really comes in and adds value to the movie. So anyways, just giving that perspective here of different movies or different plot lines coming into conflict and adding that value to what's going on. And I will say, I do love in this movie, not only do you see loss, which hasn't been a big thing in Marvel movies recently, but also you see them dwell on that loss, right? They really take that knife and twist it, if you will. Mm-hmm. You're really seeing that and being forced to sit in that emotion and realize Shuri's lost a lot. You know, mm-hmm. Ramonda, the Sovereign Queen Mother, has lost a lot. And these are not simple things to just get over.
Yeah.
So, anyways, that was a little bit of an aside, but you see... You see the engagement. They really paint this new world, introducing Namor and the people of T'Lokan as they capture... What's her face? Riri Williams and Shuri and take them to the Underwater Kingdom. And then Namor goes on this whole monologue about his life and how it's, you know, sucks and everything. And then how he came to become the king of T'Lokan and his mother and this new kingdom. What was your impression of all of that?
It was a good introduction. I mean, for one thing, it was... You can see what he's trying to do is trying to build empathy with Shuri, like trying to say, this is my people. We are normal. Like, we're another nation. Like, I have innocent people here, too. And it also helps to establish Namor's motives, more or less. Like, he isn't just your standard bad guy, like, oh, I'm doing this for this purpose or that. Like, and even in the comics, his main priority, his main goal is the protection of his people.
Right.
Of the Atlanteans, like, and he's an interesting, like, hero character in the comics. So it's like he has been a villain, he's been a hero, he's been an anti-hero. It's like he's been on the Avengers, he's been on the X-Men, he's been on all these different superhero teams.
But
regardless of where he stands, where he's been, it's like the one thing that's been consistent is like the Atlantean people are top priority. Like, he changes alliances based on what's best for his people. So
interesting.
And the movie does capture that so well, where it's like, this is my people, this is my responsibility. And so now he is motivated by some fear based on past experiences of the surface people. And he's very quick to judge and say that they need to be destroyed and you need to attack them first before they enslave us.
Right.
So it's not necessarily the best thinking, and he definitely doesn't have the best ideas, but the motive isn't wrong.
Right.
So, and the movie does show that. So,
yeah. No, he's a very interesting villain. I would say the first thing that struck me when he went on this monologue was this monologue wasn't actually pointless and stupid. You know, yes. like they bring in these monologues from these villains and they go, "Oh, I'm going to tell you my life story for no reason. And then we're going to fight, and then I'm going to lose." You know, that didn't actually happen in this one. In this one, you saw he was doing this in a way strategically. I don't know if all of his wording made a ton of sense, per se. But most of it actually did.
Yeah.
And you could see he was doing that for a purpose. He wasn't just telling his enemy what he was going to do. He actually was trying to convince his quote-unquote enemy to join sides with him so they could fight their enemies together. And so I thought that was good, first off, that there was actual intent and purpose behind his character's monologue. But second, yeah, you could definitely see his perspective and how there was, yeah, like you said, the fear going on there. There's these motivations that were driving him that were in some ways... maybe not justified, but they were understandable.
Yeah.
Right. So they definitely built him as a character well. So then they go from that to the situation where they get freed. What's her name? Nakia comes picks up Riri Williams, and Shuri, and bring them back to the Wakandan kingdom. And that causes Namor to launch his counter assault, right? Yeah. He attacks the kingdom, things blow up, and he ends up killing the queen mother, mm-hmm. right? And that's where you see, he says, I'm going to come back in, I think it was like a month, and destroy you guys if you guys don't partner with me. Because mm-hmm. he really recognizes that the people who have the vibranium are the people who have the strongest powers in their current world, right?
Yeah.
What was your impression of that attack on Wakanda?
The whole scene, it was an interesting... it really does showcase some of their... the strengths of the Tekoan people or the Atlantean people.
Yeah.
So just it shows how they could sneak into a city and cause a lot of damage really quickly. Mm-hmm. And plus how people, like just how water is their cover, their strength, and if you're right. not prepared in that way, you're kind of at a disadvantage.
Yeah.
So.
I do want to say as a side note, I thought their siren power was very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely something I haven't, I guess, seen in something that wasn't Pirates of the Caribbean. But yeah, I thought it was a cool way that if you didn't, they could just wipe out entire swaths of their enemies just by calling them to the water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, it is a cool ability.
maybe that was just a little side note. So that's fun. I thought the attack was cool. Not just because they had unique powers, but because of what it meant for the storyline. With the death of Ramonda, you had the vacancy open. And you could see that was the intent of Namor. Mm-hmm. Namor saw that if he could force Shuri into the position of being the leader of the kingdom, he could potentially get her to side with him. He knew her motivations, he knew the anger and the grief she was still dealing with the death of her brother. And he was trying to use that to leverage her in a position to be his ally against the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. Mm-hmm. Not 100% sure that's the best action if you actually wanted to get someone to be on your side, because you just killed their mom.
Yeah,
but
I think as far as forcing them to make a decision, like putting them into the driver's seat, it was a good plan. I mean, as far as to guide a certain outcome, that's debatable.
Right.
So, and I think more or less he was just trying to force her to make a decision, like against us or for us, more or less. So,
right.
I mean, it's not clear that he was actually trying to force an alliance necessarily at that point.
Sure.
Because at that point they'd already invaded his kingdom, gotten them back.
Right.
And he was kind of pissed about the.
Right. And he's willing to do whatever it takes. Yeah. Clearly.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely put them in that position. I did appreciate once again that they were willing to sacrifice characters. I'm not saying you need to kill a character every movie. Yeah. Right.
No, it's true,
but you literally see the losses that Shuri experiences throughout the movie, where she was really a side character in the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then she becomes front line and center with the death of her brother, and then a year later the death of her mother, and she's got no one. Mm-hmm. And that's scary to her, and this is something she has to deal with, something she has to wrestle with, to decide what kind of leader is she going to be, how does this reflect on her, the ruling of her mother, the ruling of her brother.
Mm-hmm.
Who does she want to be as a leader, and how can she do these things or be a good ruler while also come to peace and terms with who she is and who she wants to be in this position, right?
Yeah.
And I think that, yeah, they really built that well, that inner conflict well in this movie. So it comes to a climax where Shuri decides to come back. I just want to say, going back to that last point, that you see that reflected in the Jabari tribe leader, Mabaku, who is a counselor to her and, you know, eats his carrot and tells her his wise word of wisdom and cautions her against these things, right? But she's so enraged that she wants to do them anyways. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was your impression of the climax?
Of the final battle?
Yeah.
It was definitely a good lead up to that point where it's like she's been, like, in a sense, she's been hiding her grief. She's not been dealing with it. She's not, like, letting go. She's, like, burying herself in work and doing this and that throughout, like, before the movie started. Then right. People are trying to push her to let go of her grief. All these, like, conflicts take place. She loses her mother. She was first kidnapped. Then she loses her mother. She's been forced into the position of queen.
Uh-huh.
It's like things, she's just constantly getting pushed in this one direction, and she kind of retaliates. It's like, I'm going to hurt those who to hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
So she, and she also kind of embraces, like, because she's before the movie starts, she kind of had given up on recreating the herb for the Black Panther.
Right.
But as soon as her mother dies, she goes back to that research and, like, starts looking into, like, how can I recreate this, recreate mm-hmm. the Black Panther.
Right.
And so she goes, does a bunch of research. She recreates the herb finally after trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
And then she consumes the herb in an attempt to become the Black Panther and gets an unexpected vision.
Right, exactly. So, which is interesting because she's a skeptic, right? Mm-hmm. And so she doesn't really embrace all the traditions of Wakanda
mm-hmm.
that the rest of the tribes there do.
Yeah, she's that rebellious character more or less.
Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like this vision comes as a shock to her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah, it was a very interesting scene, especially to see Killmonger there, and it's almost like a reflection of like the path that she's heading down, right? Mm-hmm. Almost like the mind revealing to you what you want to see. Right, kind of playing out that vision of who you are or who you want to be, and then giving a visual representation of that. Yeah, it was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely almost like a mental caution to her, mm-hmm. where you're going. And she, in a way, in that moment at least, embraces that side where she is full on revenge.
Yeah.
She's ready to take that revenge, which is mm-hmm. in some ways what
mm-hmm.
Namor is doing too. Mm-hmm. But sorry, you were about to say.
No, I just was going to say that she sees it and she kind of sees what it's saying, but she also pushes back and, like, still kind of rebellious, is like, I still want revenge. So because when she gets out of the vision, she refuses to tell people who she saw in her vision, even though she's pressed on it. Like, who was it did you see? And she's right. Like, she doesn't want to say, because if she did, it would be telling everyone something is wrong. Like, yeah. Where she's, and it would be admitting that she's not heading down the right path.
Right, exactly.
So
she knows.
Mm-hmm.
She knows it's, like, the wrong thing to do,
mm-hmm.
but she's still set her heart on doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
So that really plays into the conflict, right? Because, this is a preemptive attack on Namor and his people. And she does that to get that first advantage. And you see M'Baku is very much against it, but he follows her because he understands the chain of command, if you will. He understands where his position is in the kingdom. He respects the throne and he respects her as the leader and follows her, even though he does not believe it is the right thing to do. Similar to what Okoye does in the first one, when Killmonger is the king of Wakanda, and Okoye does not think he is the right leader, but she follows him because she understands it is her position, it is the right thing to do, and she must follow the crown if the kingdom is to be cohesive.
Yes.
So
because it's in her job. Like, she's the bodyguard of the kingdom, more exactly. or less. And so it's like, her life, her position is to protect Wakanda, and that means the Black Panther, the king, whoever's in power. And so it's like, it was Killmonger at that time, and even though it wasn't something she liked, it was what she chose to do. Yeah. It wasn't until in the first movie that Black Panther, T'Challa's character, came back that she suddenly had a choice, and she immediately chose T'Challa. Right. Because, like, he was the original Black Panther, and according to tradition, he was still Black Panther.
Exactly.
So, but yeah, and in this movie, it's like, her position is still, like, that is what she lives for until she gets relieved of her duty, more or less, like, she gets let go.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's very, it was quite excellent. It was quite good. To in regards to the conflict, I keep saying it in a way that makes it sound like this is the greatest movie. It is a good movie, I would say. I would not say it's my favorite movie, but it is a good movie. Mm-hmm. And they really, the sequence of events makes sense. Mm-hmm. I would say most of my beefs with it up to that point are quite minor.
Mm-hmm.
So they have the conflict, they have the big fight out. And as a general whole, actually, the Wakandans are losing by the end of the battle, except for the position of Black Panther, the new Black Panther, Shuri, versus Namor.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on the land, the desert.
Mm-hmm.
They have that thing explode behind him after she gets speared. And then he ends up falling to the ground, and she tells him to yield instead of killing him, which is where she has that momentary vision of her mother and tells her to basically be the queen, the person she knows she is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or who she knows she should be. What was your impression of that conflict, right?
Well, it's like she's kind of forced, finally put, like, she can kill Namor, and she has to think about, like, is this the right thing to do in this moment? And she's already seen, and she has Killmonger's words pass through her head. And it's like, am I going to be like Killmonger? Am I going to be like Namor? And she kind of, and you kind of see those images of the Wakandan people and the Atlantean people. And she kind of, it's like, almost played side by side, showing that they're no different.
Right.
And it's kind of, it creates this similarity between the two peoples. And it's like, she has to struggle in that moment. Like, am I any different? How am I different?
Right.
And so she has this vision, like, show him who you are, more or less. And
yeah, it's the conflict of the mind is strong.
Mm-hmm.
And this conflict is very much one where they go, who is she going to be? Right. Yeah. This is a monumental decision. You're killing the leader of another country. Yeah. Are you going to actually do this? And she ends up choosing not to. So that really sets her as someone who chooses the right thing and doesn't choose revenge, even though she desperately, desperately wants to, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, she puts aside what she wants for what she knows will be best
right.
for her people and for everyone.
Right.
So.
Yeah, no, it was quite, quite good.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there on out, the movie wraps up, I'd say, pretty quickly, going bit by bit to clean up the pieces they left off, including Edward Ross,
Riri Williams,
the Namor and his people, and even the introduction of the son of T'Challa.
T'Challa. Which I think is kind of funny in a certain way, because it almost harkens back to the Ultimate line of Marvel Comics, which, I mean, I didn't read much of them, but I read a few. And what the Ultimate line of comics did compared to the mainstream, main comic line, is that in the Ultimate line of comics, when a character would die, at least the ones I read, they didn't come back to life.
Right.
It was like they were replaced with someone else. Like, it's how Miles Morales took over as the Ultimate Spider-Man in that universe.
Right.
And I think the same thing happened with Daredevil in that universe and a few other characters. So it was kind of funny where it's like someone else could take over as Black Panther in the future, also named T'Challa. So I don't know, like, I the way I saw it is almost like harken back to that, but also kind of like a way they could replace T'Challa without replacing Chadwick Boseman.
Right.
So
no, it's I thought that's a good point.
Yeah.
He's great. Mm-hmm. It seems like a good character potentially.
Mm-hmm.
And it leaves the door open for them, right? Mm-hmm. I thought they really developed Shuri well,
mm-hmm.
as the new Black Panther. And they can continue to go with her. They could lead to a new Black Panther.
Yeah.
And they really set things up where now the kingdom is back whole. Because the kingdom really wasn't whole even after the end of Black Panther, the first Black Panther. Even mm-hmm. with T'Challa still there, right?
Yeah.
You didn't have the flower. You didn't have, basically the flower, I guess. I don't know how you would pass on the lineage of the Black Panther without another flower.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was with the reemergence of that and now the reemergence of the lineage, you have potential for that kingdom to continue.
Yeah.
So. Cool. The big themes, I think... What really makes this stand out to me was those big themes of, you have the theme of revenge, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this was the villain. This was Namor. And the temptation for revenge versus this idea of reconciling with your past and learning to forgive, to choose forgiveness and to rise above those base responses and desires. And how that makes the true leader of the kingdom. I think that was... It was a really good message, honestly.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that... Honestly, I think it stands above the first movie, in my opinion.
No, I could see that. Actually, yeah. I mean, theme-wise and maybe story-wise, it might be stronger than the first movie.
Do you want to try this?
Which one's that? Yeah, I'll try that. good, but not as good as the pineapple.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. This podcast is sponsored by High Noon. just kidding.
Yeah, the only the only plot point that doesn't really get resolved by the end of the movie, I felt like, was the whole portrayal of Wakanda as the one who attacked the ship in the Atlantic.
That's true.
Like, that whole plotline doesn't actually get resolved by the end of the movie. It kind of, like, is left open-ended.
Yeah, you actually...
The other nations are actually kind of left assuming it was Wakanda, because they still don't know about the Atlantean people.
Yeah.
And with Shuri's promise not to reveal them, it kind of puts them in a position, like, they're taking the blame for this attack.
Yeah.
And it's kind of setting a stage of political intrigue, more or less, down the road, if that's going to happen. I don't know.
Could be. That's an excellent point.
It'll probably come into play in a future Marvel product somewhere.
Yeah. They're all interweaved.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll have to see. That's a very excellent point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that you have good reason not to blame it on Wakanda. If mm-hmm. you don't, because you... No other kingdom knows mm-hmm. that T'Lokan exists.
Mm-hmm. Like, so. The only person who might know, I mean, the only people who know are like Everett Ross.
Right.
And kind of knows, as well as a Fontaine, the new director character who's been popping up all over the place. That female character.
Does she show up in other
episodes? She was in Falcon and Winter Soldier.
Okay.
She was also at the very end of the Black Widow movie.
I don't remember that. I haven't been following the TV shows, so full honesty here.
I haven't followed most. Actually, I followed the first few, mm-hmm. and she showed up in some of the first few, which is the only reason I know. But yeah, she shows up and recruits, what's his name? Jack Flag, or the guy they tried to make Captain America in the Falcon and Winter Soldier.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So they replaced, she recruits him, and at the end of Black Widow, she kind of recruits Yelena Belova, the Black Widow, Natasha Romanoff's sister. Yeah. Yeah. And from my understanding, based on what I know behind the scenes of Marvel, they are setting up a Thunderbolts movie, and they're kind of using her to kind of get that going. So, like, they're recruiting the, like, villains and anti-heroes from these side areas into a team, more or interesting. Less.
Yeah, I did think she was an interesting character in this mm-hmm. movie, especially with that previous relationship with Martin Freeman's character, Ross. But it was all just so tangential that it didn't seem that important.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. It didn't contribute much to the main storyline of Wakanda Forever.
Right.
It only contributed a little points here and there, and kind of pushed Martin Freeman's character in certain to a new place by the end of the movie.
Right.
I mean, yeah, that's the only big flaw I can see about Wakanda Forever. Is like these some of these subplots. It's debatable whether they contributed much to the movie as a whole. The main storyline itself is good. I'll agree with that. The subplots, though, do detract maybe a little bit, because it not so that they're bad, they just raise questions as to whether they're necessary.
Sure.
Like, they don't make the story stronger. They kind of add fluff to the story that may not have been necessary.
Right. Yeah, especially Riri Williams, in mm-hmm. my mind. If you really wanted Ironheart, mm-hmm. is that her character's name? The other Iron Man, I guess, if you will, in the universe, fine. Mm-hmm. It's good. But it didn't really add to the storyline that mm-hmm. much. So,
yeah.
Anyways.
Like, the only thing Riri Williams accomplished, her character accomplished more or less, is getting Shuri kidnapped into the Atlantean people's prison or whatever.
Right.
Like, it effectively got her kidnapped, and it's how she gets introduced to their society, to their people. Right. It's how she sees them. Like, that's the only that's the only thing that contributed to the storyline, that her character, that Riri Williams, contributed to the overall arching story.
Yeah.
So, aside from the cool special effects and battle scenes, whatever. Right. Obviously, so.
Cool. Well, let's rate it. On a scale of 1 to 10, how do you think this one lines up?
Okay. So this movie definitely, I would say this movie is better than some of the other Marvel movies as of late. Uh-huh. It's not the best movie, in my opinion.
Right.
I mean, I don't think this movie is a classic. I don't think it's, like, so it definitely isn't that high of a rated movie. But it is better than a lot of the other movies and properties, some of the other movies that have been coming out, in especially in Marvel, as of late. Yeah. It's even better than the last movie we reviewed, Ant-Man. I would say
that's gonna come out after this one, so I'm sorry guys, you have to wait a minute for
that. I'm gonna give it a rating of 6.5.
okay,
that's where I want to put it at. So
okay, yeah,
because it was good on a certain level, but it wasn't the best movie, nor is it a classic.
Sure.
So that's what I would say.
I personally enjoyed it. Definitely enjoyed, and maybe this is because I wasn't expecting a movie that actually lets you sit in your emotion of it, right? They actually made you consider some of the struggle that the characters faced. Mm-hmm. I would give it a 7.
Okay.
I probably enjoyed it a little better because I was expecting it to be garbage. it was a pleasant surprise mm-hmm. to me. Would not say it was the best Marvel movie ever, mm-hmm. but definitely thought it added value to the series as a whole. Mm-hmm. I thought it was better than the first one. I think it definitely built on the past and added extra value, which is what a sequel should do. So, good movie, worth the watch, is what I would say for sure, especially if you're into Marvel movies. This definitely is not one that is going to detract from the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
Super. Well, there you go. Hope you all enjoyed. We will see you back here next time.
Wakanda forever.
Until then, see ya.
Sayonara.
If you have a movie you want reviewed or have some feedback to give us, send us a message at alostplot.com. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review. It really helps other people find our podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode and look forward to seeing you back with us next time. See you then.